Hi, I'm Carmen Leif Jenkins, Managing Editor of the International Journal of Stroke, and I attended the Stroke Society Australasia's Smart Strokes Conference this year. I've developed a collection of podcasts for your listening pleasure. In this podcast, you'll be privy to an important and insightful conversation on the big questions in endovascular thrombectomy between Professor Stephen Davis, who's the Director of the Melbourne Brain Centre at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and the University of Melbourne, and Maynak Goyal, Interventional Radiologist from the University of Calgary.
I'm Steve Davis. I'm Director of the Melbourne Brain Centre at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and University of Melbourne.
Mayank Goyal, I'm an interventional neuroradiologist from University of Calgary.
Well, Mayank, great to talk to you. What are the big questions in endovascular thrombectomy in your mind?
Well, it's two big questions, and I'll take them one at a time. One is how to get the correct patient to the correct hospital the first time around, especially in geographies such as yours and ours, which is a very big piece of land and relatively concentrated people. And the question is, how do you set it up, not just in a way that you have transportation systems, but you're able to create local expertise for giving IVTPA, but to take those patients which have high risk of EVT to a central place. That, to my mind, is sort of the single biggest challenge going forward, and that is not just a scientific challenge or a medical challenge. It's actually a political challenge. It's a turf battle challenge. It's more complicated. The second part, which is somewhat related, is rather than asking the question, which patient with large vessel occlusion should you treat, the question now is, which patient with large vessel occlusion should you not treat? And the question is flipped on its head now, and that is becoming a tricky part in terms of sort of how to solve that problem of deciding which is the patient not to treat. And based on literature that is already there or will be there in a few years, you will pretty much have justification to do whatever you want, that, like you have right now for GA versus no GA. The data is all over the map. So
you and I know, have different views on advanced imaging and selection. And I think you feel that speed is everything, and perhaps there's less role for advanced imaging than we do in Melbourne, where we feel even though there's uncertainty, it gives us prognostic information, it allows us more precise definition of the stroke. What's your take on perfusion CT at this point of time?
I think the way to think about it is that at the time of that emergency situation, there are only two decisions to be made. TPA, no TPA, EVT, no EVT. That's plain and simple. The rest of it happens at 24 hours and doesn't matter. We don't need to think about it too much. From the perspective of that decision-making, and especially when our mindset is we are trying to exclude patients rather than include patients, you have to think Bayesian, you have to think multifactorial. So you have to take into account a patient's age, 85-year-old versus 45-year-old, time from onset, 1 hour versus 7 hours, pre-morbid status, is there cancer or not, what are the patient's wishes, are they coming from a nursing home, and then put that into the perspective of imaging. And when you look at it that way, actually the imaging is very simple. And we still have to keep in mind time is brain. And to my mind, perfusion actually creates more confusion. And there's probably a whole bunch of patients that deserve to be treated but are getting excluded because people see this red color on perfusion imaging and say, oh yeah, the brain is already dead, but it isn't. Perfusion imaging does not tell us what brain is dead. It gives a probabilistic map, depending on how you set it up, of what may die or may not die. And as we get faster and better at opening vessels, all the stuff that perfusion calls as dead is actually more and more coming back to life. So in the overall big picture, I find it just a waste of time.
Well, I think we'll agree to disagree on on that, but you're right. I think the next few years we'll learn more about what of these large cores is salvageable, what we can actually do. What do you think the time window is for endovascular thrombectomy?
Again, I don't think like the way that we currently define time window is by last seen normal, right? So which is like patient 10:30 p.m. last seen normal, went to sleep, coming with a stroke. So what is the actual time window? We really don't know. My increasing view is that one of the beauties of Diffuse 3 and Dawn is that they gave us a very good idea of natural history of disease, which is extremely dismal, and that too when these patients were carefully selected to be the best of the late patients, which means that the average natural history is going to be even worse than that, which means that we don't have to do very much to beat that natural history. So if we believe that by 10% improvement in outcome, we are doing a worthwhile therapy, which is an NNT of T, which NNT of 10, which is pretty good for medicine. I don't think we need to think about it too much. You see an occluded vessel, it's got decent imaging, patient is worth fighting for, has significant deficit, go open the vessel.
Let me ask you just a little lateral question. What about the other approach of boosting the collaterals? Do you see any progress in that area? We've had this enormous advance in thrombectomy, opening up the artery. But the collaterals is the other side of the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's been difficult to make progress in that area.
Yeah, no, I do think that there are these collateral therapies of various kinds. Like ultimately the therapy that we are testing, Escape NA1, is the compound NA1, which is neuroprotection, which will potentially keep the neurons alive while you go open the vessel. There may be something related to cooling. There are all kinds of stuff that is happening in the world of cooling for localized cooling. There can be stuff related to augmentation of collaterals. But ultimately, the way that I see it is you still got to go open the vessel and you have to set these things up in such a way that they're simple, they're easily implementable in the ambulance at the primary stroke center, et cetera, et cetera. And then while you go sort of open the vessel. What is the thing that is sort of like the way to think about it is 2015, all these trials came out and we are sort of in a honeymoon period where all this exciting stuff is happening and things. And we are reaching to a point where all the big stuff is, we are arguing about small little things and stuff. I do think if Escape NA1 turns out to be positive, that'll be a start of a new, so to speak, honeymoon where there'll be a whole bunch of excitement around neuroprotection. And from our perspective, from Michael Hill and my perspective, we are putting a lot of hard work into Escape NA1. Our enrollment is going amazingly well. We should be done around a year from now and stuff. And we'll find out if the way I see it is, if it's positive, then it's great. But if it's not positive, you learn from it and go back and do it again.
So. Yeah. With another agent, would you say, if it's not possible?
Well, it depends. We're collecting all kinds of data. And so the highest level is we are positive, which is great. We are sort of superstars, whatever. The second part is there is some signal, but we are not being able to get signal to noise sufficient to the traditional 0.05 kind of thing. So then the question is understand the data, figure out how do we reduce the noise level and go do with the same drug again.
Now, let me ask you something that's been controversial for us, and that is treatment of the very elderly. So we're talking now people in their 90s, for example. What's your feeling about that? Obviously, the question is, this is a very dramatically effective treatment at any age. Do you draw limitation of treatment in the very elderly, or do you go full bore pretty much regardless of age?
Yeah, I think, again, like the way to think about it is, and I'm going to sort of present this in my talk, is that there are factors that influence outcome which are before, at the time of decision-making, are known. Age, pre-morbid status, smoker, diabetes, whatever. So-called what a typical clinician would say biological age, right? And that's a combination of the actual age plus all the other factors that go with it. And that, I think, is a major, major prognostic factor. The second part is time from onset. Third factor is imaging. But there's another factor, which is the family structure, socioeconomic status, expectation of outcome, this, that, and the other, and stuff. I recently had a patient, 59-year-old, professor at the university. He came in with left-sided, left M monoclusion, changes, aspects of whatever, 5-6 kind of thing, 59-year-old. But his wife said he's got a clear living will that if he's got significant deficit, especially in his speech, he does not want to be treated. So we're going to see more and more of that, where older people will have living will associated with it and an expectation of outcome, especially if they're alone, that MRS4 may not be good enough, 3.5 may not be good enough. One thing that I do tell all my super old patients is that your best case scenario is an MRS of 3. Like, obviously, you explain it in the way that you explain it, sort of thing. But to have, based on Hermes data, have an 85-year-old reach MRS of 0.2 is extremely unlikely.
Yeah.
So that data, not only do you have to do it from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, from a societal standpoint, but also from the point of view of, are you really doing these patients any benefit?
Yeah. Well, you work in a powerhouse in Calgary with a very, very strong team. How have you been so successful with the local health authorities in organising your own system to ensure speedy access to thrombectomy, for example?
I could answer this question as a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of thing. So from a glass half full perspective, Canadian systems are centralized. So the whole of Alberta we have this thing called Alberta Health Services, and we have 57 hospitals in Alberta of varying sizes. There are two big academic centers, there's a bunch of sort of community centers, but they're all campuses of Alberta Health Services, and we have one CEO for the whole thing. So there's no competition across this thing. It's basically one health authority which takes care of it, one central PAC system, one central imaging system, one central hospital replacement system, and there is no financial advantage or disadvantage for a patient or an ambulance from going to one place to the other. But that obviously is the glass half full side of it. There's a glass half empty side of it because it creates a sort of a very sort of socialist sort of environment. There isn't that much of an incentivization process for working hard and things like that. But the third part of it is, which I increasingly believe as I travel around the world a lot, is that I do find a bunch of highly driven people come together by random chance who are sort of working hard, and they build something up, then they move on. And the center goes down, another center comes up, and it goes down. It's very difficult in the modern environment to have a process of succession planning and have people who sort of just gel together and just will keep on building over 100 years. I don't think that's going to happen. So the way I see it is that ultimately the three of us, Michael Hill, Andrew, and myself, we came together, and we have varying qualities of a Venn diagram where we complement each other very well, and we hired the right people, and we, you know, that classical approach of finders, minders, grinders kind of thing. So I would say Andrew is our minder, takes care of everything. Michael and I are the finders, but within we have super brilliant grinders like Bijoy and Muhammad Al-McLaffy and all, who put in all the hard work and get the papers written and stuff. So, you know, I think it's the right combination which works for now. But I do think all these things are a house of cards. Who knows where it'll go tomorrow? So,
do you think we'll ever see anything as exciting as endovascular thrombectomy again in internal medicine?
Yeah, I do think if neuroprotection takes off, I do think that'll be like the next cocaine, so to speak, which will get. And I do think the extent and usefulness of neuroprotection will be far beyond EVT in terms of the number of human beings that will get affected, because what will happen is if one thing takes off, big pharma will come in, all kinds of additional stuff will come in, and it will start to become like cancer therapy, where it becomes like rather than one, then it becomes 1+1 drug that gets into 1+2+3 kind of thing. It will build up from there, and that I think will be super exciting, and not to mention the fact it will have all kinds of benefits, whether you're going on an expedition to Antarctica, or you're going for deep sea diving, or you're doing heart surgery, or you're doing anesthesia. You can just think of the unlimited potential of that. Wherever neurons are at risk, you just give it preventatively, especially if the side effects are low. So,
you've been listening to a conversation with Professor Stephen Davis, Director of the Melbourne Brain Centre, the Royal Melbourne Hospital and University of Melbourne, and Maynard Goyal, Interventional Radiologist from the University of Calgary, recorded at the Stroke Society Australasia Smart Strokes Conference in 2018. This is one part of a series of podcasts from that event. Please take a look at our Podbean site for more. The International Journal of Stroke is the flagship publication of the World Stroke Organization. Please do consider becoming a member. You can find links to membership in the text of this podcast or at www.world-stroke.com.